In today's episode, we have Alexander Denin, who has overcome being a felon, having his mental health drained by the American prison system, and is now a successful model, actor, and father.
Man, my whole life is on like standstill. Nothing gets to go forward. And now I'm like taking these hits and I'm sitting in a prison cell. So you have nothing at all on. You're sitting in this like cold, dim cell. There's no windows. You don't have a book. You don't have anything. I never seen this guy, but I like became friends with him over months just talking to him because I had nobody else to talk to. What you're looking up to, kid, if I had a second of your time to go do something different, I would. Like, don't be that same mistake that I made. Go do something great. Promise me you're gonna go do this. So he made me promise him that I would go to an agency. He's telling me this ain't what you want. This isn't the lifestyle. You'll be here in this prison with me sitting the rest of your life. Literally, I have friends that were inside prison that sat like 9 years inside segregation and didn't see a human being for like 9 years. So you think about that, like, what does that do to your mental health?
Hi, welcome back to another episode of The Mindful Space. Today we have Alexander. How are you today?
Very good. How are you?
Good. Thanks for coming. So tell everybody what we're going to be talking about today and a little intro of yourself.
Yeah. So my name is Alexander the Great. I'm an ex-con turned model, actor, musician, influencer. I love saying everything, but I'd rather show people rather than tell them. But yeah, talk a little bit about my life story and I guess just how everything transpired to a life of prison, you know, and turning into life of entertainment or a career in entertainment. So,
or anything at all, right?
Yeah.
Just getting out of that life.
A better life, yeah.
So let's start from the beginning. How did you get into the prison system?
Yeah. So I guess taking everybody back to like the earliest of my run-ins with the law, I'd say, like the justice system would be, I guess like the age 16, 17 was like my early rebellion, hanging around negative crowds, negative people. And it was always like I was looking up to like this figure, whether it was my older brother or like this role model, right? And just for future topic, I always tell people, if you're looking to like find the source of why there's trouble in somebody, look up to who they most look up to. Okay. Look up to their role model. And that was for me, my older brother was my role model. So like falling into that rebellion, whether it was like gang lifestyles or dealing drugs or so many bad things that, it just transpired into that. And as a youth, I just embraced that, just wanting to be like the best that I could be. But before all the trouble, I used to be a skateboarder. I used to have like a normal life. There was like There was a normal teenager. Yeah. I used to go to Disneyland with my parents. Like there was a normal life before the trouble that led up to it. So
yeah. And so at what point you said it started 16 when you started getting in trouble.
Yep.
Did it start with simple things like, I don't know, theft or just skating when you were not supposed to be skating?
Yeah.
How did it escalate?
Yeah. That's a good question. I think that like just skateboarding in general, just being like this like rebellious nature, you know, people get off my step skateboarding or something. Like, I don't know. It's not like I wanted to turn to any like bad choices or hurt my community and my family, which was affected the most through my poor choices all throughout those years. But I don't know. I think that like I'd come to this point in my life where I felt like just worthless. Like there wasn't much of me to offer to society. So it was like, I'm just going to do whatever I want to do. I'm just going to turn to this like negative lifestyle. I'm going to just reap whatever I can, you know, financially, mentally, you know, all the different aspects of just taking from the community and people that I love. And,
of course.
Yeah.
Now I know, or from what I read, correct me if I'm wrong. Yep. You almost went to jail once and were saved, and that wasn't enough, right? Okay, can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah. So, like in my adolescence, leading up to going to actual prison and doing some time, I'd been to county jail a few different times where, like, okay, they were telling me stop smoking marijuana or like quit getting into trouble where, you know, you're getting minor consumptions, drinking underage or something like that. And it was like, I was just like, I'm going to do whatever I want to do. And that led to trouble in school where I was getting kicked out of high school eventually, where I got kicked out at 10th grade. And then immediately I got my GED, but that like led me on this path where I was telling my family, my parents, I just want to get to work. But in reality, I just wanted to go do whatever I wanted to do in life. So it just kind of like transcribed to like trouble in school, trouble in my personal life, my relationships with my family, my loved ones. They're like seeing somebody that I wasn't, you know?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then at what point was it that you ended up in real prison? How old were you?
Yeah. Yeah. So I would end up going to prison at 19 years old. But with anybody who's ever been involved with the judicial system, they know it's a drawn out process. So there's like the crime you're charged with, there's going through the court system, there's actually being convicted of the crime or settling for a lesser charge. For me, it was at 19 years old. And just to give you guys a little story on like the actual event that sent me to prison, when I was 19 years old, I was driving down a county road, just an old county road in Minnesota. So country road out in the middle of nowhere, driving down this road, and this car tries to run us off the road. And me and my friend are in the vehicle. He's driving. I'm in the passenger seat. I'm just like, this guy's probably drunk. Let's just keep going, right? So we're hauling butt. We're going like 100 miles per hour. And it comes to the point where I'm like, okay, we're probably going to get ran off the road. Like, and there was no antagonizing before. There was nothing that like should have elicited this guy trying to chase us. So I get out of the car eventually when I tell my friend, like, pull over, we're going to wreck. At that time, I had a weapon on me. I had a knife just for protection and probably not for the right reasons, thinking like I'm a 19-year-old kid that's running around, you know, dealing drugs, hanging with the wrong people. I had a weapon for the wrong reasons, if you think of it. And dealing with this for years, I thought about, you know, is did I do the right thing during this night that this incident happened that would send me to prison? So this guy tries to run us off the road. I get out. I ask this guy, hey, what's going on? What's the deal? Why are you, you know, just trying to reason?
Run us over, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And immediately this guy comes running at me. And it was so dark. It was 3 a.m. All I can really remember is a guy with a mohawk, like tattoos, and just like coming swinging at me. And from that moment, I felt like I had to defend myself. So I took the knife out and like, it was just so quick. Yeah. Like anybody who's ever been involved in something, it's so quick. But I ended up stabbing this guy. And while we were fighting, having this altercation, I think I dealt with it for years, but like I was overcoming with like the emotions during the time of like fight or flight. Like, what do I do? I'm a 19-year-old kid. How do I handle this?
Yeah.
And after I ended up getting to the altercation, stabbing the guy, he took off running through like a cornfield, and me and a friend took off driving, left him there. And then 3 weeks later, the U.S. Marshals would raid my family's home looking for me, connecting the dots and everything like that. But I didn't call the police. I didn't call the authorities.
You didn't cooperate. I mean, from what they look at it.
Yeah, at all. I think the story would have been 100% different had I called the police, told them what happened. But I was scared. I guess I was just scared, 19-year-old, you know?
Yeah. And after a week, 2 weeks, you probably hoped
they
wouldn't find out.
Thinking it was going to go away. And then, like, it's such a crazy story when you dive into, like, my backstory for everybody. Like, the guy who ended up getting stabbed was an ex-girlfriend of mine's cousin. Oh. And 3 weeks later, they arrested me because the guy I was with ended up telling on me. And it's just crazy how things transpired and how small town incident kind of happens. You know, there's only like 2,000 people that live there. So
exactly.
Yeah.
Wow. So at this moment, you find yourself in prison. How many years did they give you?
So at the end of the court proceedings, I had ended up taking a deal for 98 months. And the stipulation, so it's a stay of imposition. So what they did was they were saying, we're not going to send you to prison right away. We're going to put this time over your head. If you have any mess ups, if you don't complete the stipulations of probation, then we're going to send you off to prison. And I thought, okay, wow, like I'm going to get out, like I'm going to get 20 years of probation. And all the guards were telling me, nobody's ever completed 20 years of probation. We've never seen anybody do this. They all come back. So for me, I was like, oh, I'm going to get out. No, it was within like 1 month. I was in a bar where the police recognized me because I had such a high profile case, recognized me, said, can we see your ID? That was some trouble for me right there. And it would just end up being a couple probation violations that eventually I went to county jail where my probation officer just said, make up your mind. You're going to prison. Or you're just going to fight this until then. Cause I could have fight the charges that I had. I'd acquired new charges, just being out in the community.
Just breaking the probation.
And breaking the stipulation. So
then what happened at that point?
I would end up going to the county jail in the community I lived in. And I just told the judge pretty much I'm ready to go to prison. So I knew 98 months prison was what was coming no matter what. There wasn't really more coming. So I went to prison. I knew in the state that I lived in, I'd be doing 2/3 of that. So at the very end of my sentence, I ended up doing 6 years. But during that prison sentence, everybody's telling me, like, don't ever plan on your release date being what you see on paper. Like, you're going to get in trouble. You're going to mess up. It's going to get extended further. So I'm looking at it like, man, I'm going to be in prison much longer than this is even telling me. And, you know, But prison was crazy. I think no matter how tough you are, and I used to watch all these shows about like prison shows or like a quote from like Tupac saying like, you're not a man until you go to prison. But when you get there, I don't care how tough you are, like looking up at the galleys and like having grown men that are like gangbangers, like screaming at you as a kid, like it's intimidating.
It's intimidating.
You
can imagine.
Yeah.
So on that first day of going into prison, how was your mental health? How were you in shock? Were you nervous? Like what was going through your whole body?
So I think that initially like walking through those gates, so going through what they called the castle. So St. Cloud Prison was the intake prison I was going into. And it was like, it was almost like cattle call. There was like 20 of us inmates shackled up going through
like
this.
Like the movies.
Just like the movies. It's just like the movies. Yeah. Jumpsuits, orange jumpsuits coming through this big brick door and then just being putting into this bullpen is what they call it. So all glass. We're just sitting in there. There's one metal toilet. We're all shackled in there, you know. So, I mean, if you got to go to the bathroom, you got to figure it out however you're doing it. It was just like, it was a stressor that I, really put myself into, but I didn't expect it to be so, impactful on me. Like when we finally would walk through those doors that would come into the, C house is what they called inside prison. It was like looking up five galleys high. There's people standing at the gates,
just like watching,
yelling, screaming. Not just watching, screaming at the top of their lungs, fresh meat. Like it's just like what she was saying, like thinking the movies, right? They're yelling fresh meat. There was a guy that had like super blonde, long hair beside me. They're calling him sunshine. I'm going to get you later. And like saying these things and the guards are telling you, do not say nothing. Don't react.
Cause that's what they're looking for.
That's what they're looking for. Yeah. They're looking for you to look at them. They're looking for you to say something. I can even remember like just normal people who I have no clue what they were in prison for, but like seeing them look into some guy's cell. And then like that next day when they're walking to chow, like getting snatched into that cell and like, physically assaulted, like. And if I would have looked, it would probably would have happened to me. So like, you don't even look in prison. Okay. You don't look at nothing. You don't look into nobody's cell, not unless it's your cell. You just kind of mind your own business. But for me, like going in there, seeing this galley, seeing how it was, seeing that like, I'm going to have to shower with like 40 other people. And there's a nozzle that has like three spouts out of it. So you're literally standing like next to some strangers showering and,
and you can't look.
You're like this, And I'm like a skinny 19-year-old and there's like two big convicts that have been there for, you know, 20 years or something. But yeah, the mental health aspect is, I think too, like I seen people try to, they were committing suicide or trying to commit suicide the day that I got in there, people slitting their wrists in their cell, just people screaming, like the mental health was real. For me, I'm glad that it wasn't so intense as, you know, the other people were going through or something that like maybe I collapsed and wasn't able to deal with. And I think of it like this, like the first week in there, they do this assessment where they will go, grab a counselor, pull an offender out, and they'll go over the story and they'll talk about like, you know, your history of like committing crimes, what's on the history of like your record. So they can talk about those things. They'll talk about your mental health, your relationships, and they give you this score. And the score kind of dictates like your aptitude as a prisoner and if you'll come back. So they give this high score that says like, they gave me a score that said I was like 100% coming back. It was massive score. Oh, and I told my mom about it at home and my mother was just like, that's so devastating. Like,
but that's the first day when you're like at your worst.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do they do that aptitude test or that test? As so they you don't progress,
No.
You're judged on the first day.
Just when you're entering, yes.
Interesting. Sounds so smart.
Yeah. You think of it like they should do it on the reentry side, but I don't know why they do this. Yeah, it's called some star meter system that is all gauged towards whether you're going to be coming back or not. And I use that as motivation. Like, I am not coming back, like no matter what this damn score says. But just that too, like I said, those first 2 years of my life, the mental health was like the biggest attack on myself, that just like trying to find myself. I didn't have a job. The money, things were just so hard for me in there that I thought like, I'm going to just have to survive however I can, which was tattooing, brewing hooch and selling it to other prisoners and like adopting this negative lifestyle in there that needed to be broke so I can get out and do good, you know?
Well, I think it's crazy that you can tattoo and get alcohol, but you can't get mental health counseling.
Yeah. You can get all the other things. Like, you can get pills or you can get,
anything you want except counsel. Sorry. That's out of line.
I think that a lot of, and I'm not speaking for all correctional officers or staff, but I think that a lot of them think that, you know, they're the disciplinaries. They have to instill the discipline. Like, you're here to sit and do your time, but that's not enough. Like, I'm here to discipline you. So like, 1 out of 10, you'll find a guard who speaks to you that like, man, you treat me like a human. Yeah, you treat me like a human and you make me feel like I should stay away from this place. The other ones feel like I just raise havoc and never leave if that's what you want or something, you know? Yeah. And that's the mentality with a lot of people. I think if you look overseas in like Sweden or different places like that where they have prison systems where they take more of like a social person approach where it's like, they're acting on their mental state or dealing with things in the right manner. I don't think 18 months of training to become a correctional officer is enough for that. So
exactly. And at that point, how would you say your mental health was when you got to prison?
Yeah. So it's crazy that you asked that because this is like the first time even having such a wide social media platform, like this is the first time I've openly spoken about things, even like the first month in prison. I'd say my mental health was like probably the worst it had ever been. Yeah. I'd had this like girl on and off that I was dating at the time. And she told me that she was pregnant. So like I was expecting a child going into prison, right? Like the week going into prison, like I'm finding out I'm going to be a dad. So I'm thinking like, man, I'm going to get out in 5 years. The kid's going to be this old. So I'm dealing with that. And I'm just dealing with like my family had not cut me off because they stuck by with me, but they were so disappointed in me that it was like, they weren't really like they'd pick up phone calls, but it wasn't like they were sending me money to call them. So it was just like such a struggle. I felt like I was by myself in a cell dealing with this. And I can remember one day being up at like the top of the galley. It's like 5 stories high, way up there at the top. Had my cell by myself, and somebody had dropped off mail to my cell, and it was like these emails that people from the outside could type out, and it could just be a little printed, kind of like mail but faster. But I remember getting one of these, and it was like I couldn't come out of my cell because I was in trouble for some small stuff. I was still in my rebellion.
Always in trouble.
Yeah. Being inside prison. Yeah. I was like right on my rebellion for the first 2 years. But I got this letter from the girl that I was seeing at the time. And it was like a letter pretty much saying like, I can't take this anymore. Like, I don't want to be with you anymore, which is common. Like, everybody thinks a girl is going to stay with you. Yeah, it's 100% common. Yeah, I should have been prepared for it mentally. But then she told me that she had lost the baby. And I don't know to this day whether it was true or not, but like, it was like mentally going through that in that cell was like, dang, like I just lost like a child that I thought I was going to have. And then I'm looking at the 98 months. I didn't think the 6 years was going to be that, but I'm looking at this long prison sentence is like, man, my whole life is on like standstill. Nothing gets to go forward. And now I'm like taking these hits and I'm sitting in a prison cell. But I don't know. I that's a lot of what built me too, though, because that time where I struggled the most, that struggling inside a prison cell, not coming out, and like small things like having my shoes stolen, like the first day I was in prison, like small little things that just like mentally I'm like, oh my goodness, I can't take this.
If you wanted to get help, mental health help in prison, can you?
That's a good question. I don't think so. I think that it's like a prescription they'll hand you, and that
like a psychiatrist.
Like you can talk to some people, but I mean, I don't think prison's not the setting where you're going to find that help, whether it's like medical help, mental health help. Like there's psychologists, and I even took I took courses or like certain studies they had on prisoners when I was there. And looking back at everything, there wasn't really help. There wasn't the mental health help that was needed. And there's people that need it way worse than my situation. Looking back, like, I don't know. I think it's neglected a lot inside the prison systems. Yeah.
There was an incident that you were in solitary confinement for 2 months.
Yep.
How was that?
Yeah. So the experience is degrading for anybody watching. Like, if you could just imagine how degrading it would be to be put in a situation where, like, each time I'd been brought to the segregation, to the hole, and I'd gone a couple times, a couple different months, for extended months times, it was always for something so minimal that I looked upon like as like, Jesus, I'm just taking another hit. Like, why can't I get a break? Like, one time I had a fingernail clipper in my pocket, ones that I could buy off canteen, ones that weren't contraband or anything, but it was in my pocket. It left my cell, and I went through a metal detector going to chow hall, and it beeped, and they sent me to, sent me to the hole. But you know, when you get there, they strip you down, so you have nothing at all on. You're sitting in this like cold, dim cell.
There's no windows.
You like have a, you don't have a book. You don't have anything. You have like this little rubber pen. You don't really get paper to write on. So like, there's no use for the pen. And there's all these, the holes, I think it's meant to like mentally break you, because then a week later they pull you out and tell you what you did wrong, what your discipline is.
So you're just there by yourself.
Yeah.
And with people your thoughts.
Yeah. With your thoughts. People are screaming in the doors, beside you. Like, just the screaming doesn't stop for like 72 hours until they're tired. Like, people are pissed off. They're mad. Like, mental health too is down there. They're just not being treated with. And
how did you deal with it?
So to be honest, as weird as this sounds, it's like talking through the toilet, talking through the vent to the person that's next to you. You know, it's weird. Like, you form a bond with this voice through a toilet, or a voice through this, like air vent duct to the next side. I never seen this guy, but I like became friends with him over months, just talking to him, cause I had nobody else to talk to. But like doing stuff like that, working out, your mental health can deteriorate so much just being in there talking to yourself, not having anybody to talk to. A guard will come by and flash a light, but they're not going to talk to you even if you say hi or something like that. And maybe it's not a big deal. Just shut up and sit there and do your time or something. But
I mean, I think that's like torture.
Yeah. Right? I mean, there's people, literally, I have friends that were inside prison that sat like 9 years inside segregation and didn't see a human being for like 9 years. So you think about that. Like, what does that do to your mental health? What does that do to
How do you expect for the people that do end up getting out of jail, how do you expect they're going to go be in society and socialize and communicate if you just have them isolated, you know? It just doesn't make sense. Was there a turning point for you inside the prison, or what was your turning point that made you get out of that rebel stage?
Yeah. So I'd have to say that my first 2 years of my 6-year prison bid was spent like doing tattoos, brewing liquor, fighting people, defending myself a lot of the time. Like, that was like the hardest time of my life, being inside prison those first couple 2 years. But I just mentally kept telling myself, I need to work my way down. And for a lot of people inside prison, there's this point system. For everybody inside prison, there's a point system that custody points that continue to lower. And that's dictates, you know, the trouble you've been in that can lower you to lower custody. So I just kept looking at this number as like, I need to get to a lower custody to get to better opportunity. And I did. So like I was looking every 6 months, 3 points would come off mine. And I got a super high amount for a young age. So I was like sent to a hardened prison where people weren't getting out. So it was just devastating. All I ever heard was, you're going to gladiator school. You're going to gladiator school. You're going to learn how to fight. You're going to learn how to defend yourself. Oh, yeah. And so then when I saw like the lunch bag that said where I was going, which was Rush City Prison, I was going gladiator school. I was like, oh, crap. Like, yeah, I'm going to like somewhere super tough. Yeah. So that was the first 2 years. When I got transferred to a medium custody, I would end up getting accepted to this program called the Interchange Freedom Initiative. And it's ran by Prison Fellowship. It's a Christian-based program, 18 months, intense, supervised by counselors that like really digs into who you are as a person, the crime you committed, and like what you're doing to rebuild yourself. And I think what changed the most during this time in prison was like, I got pulled from this community of people who were stabbing people, who were not looking to change. And I got put into this community where like, oh wow, these people really do want to change, or at least they're being motivated to. If not, they're going to get kicked out. And I think the success rate for this program was like 78% or something. Like,
well, that's great.
It was like a super high rate for people lasting in there. It wasn't very high. Like out of 44 people, I think we had like 12 at the end after 18 months that actually made it. Yep. In class 41 is what it was called. It was a huge transformation being in that community of people that like want to see good out of everybody and encourage it.
But you have to lower yourself to be able to be admitted into that program. It's not a program that's for everyone.
Nope. Let me rephrase everything. Like with this program, there was no benefits. Like there's other early release programs inside prisons. This did nothing other than like for yourself. So being admitted to this program and sticking into it for 18 months was like a big time for people that saw at the end of it. They're like, I'm not getting anything, nothing.
Yeah.
You know, they could go somewhere else to a boot camp and get like 4 years off or, you know, can get a huge chunk of time off for their programming.
Of course.
Yep.
Now, so you found faith, right? What happens, and this is a general question, what happens to prisoners after you get released? Did you get released right after that program, or you did the whole 6 years?
Yep. So I ended up doing that whole 6 years. So it was 2 years inside the close custody, which was hell. And then I would end up doing 3 years, so 18 months at that program. Mm-hmm. After the program, I would go outside the fence of the program to a minimum custody. And from that minimum custody prison, I was going into the community. I was working in a town called Eden Prairie. So I was like working with the city, helping building playgrounds. There was tons of cool stuff that was being done there too. But
that's amazing.
Yep.
So once you're out of jail, what happens? Do they just kind of throw you out there? Good luck with everything.
Yeah. So it's weird with reentry. That's like a huge topic with people in the prison industry or just like advocating for prisoners. For me, getting out of Minnesota prison, it was, here's a $500 check that you've earned. You know, I worked for it at 25 cents an hour in the kitchen or whatever, raising it up, putting it towards this fund for release. So you get a $500 check. You might get a printout of like maybe where there's some resources, but other than that, there's not really resources for people getting out. You have to search out for those organizations that are already out there looking to help the prisoners. And I mean, honestly, people getting out of prison need help with everything. They need help with how to dress, how to cut their hair, how to do an interview, how to maybe even brush their teeth. Like nobody tells them how to do these things. So I think like reentry is lacking so much from the people who call themselves a correctional facility or rehabilitation, or, you know, you have to be actively doing that. Otherwise, you can't really claim it, I don't think.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Did you face any type of stigma when you went back and you were trying to look for jobs or just trying to incorporate yourself in society?
Oh, yeah. And I still to this day face stigmas of just being an ex-con. That's why, like, I openly tell people I'm an ex-con. That's, like, the first thing I launch.
I think it's a joke. Like, wait, you're right.
Like, no, I'm 100% an ex-convict. Like,
okay.
I tell people, I think that stigma is going to carry with me forever, too, and I just have to live with it. Or I knew this guy who was going to get a pardon from the governor in Minnesota to get his record expunged, and he didn't choose to do it. And I asked him, like, why? And he's like, that felony that I have on my record has kept me in check all these years to never go back and do that stuff. Okay. Like, because if I got it off, I could get another one and maybe be fine. But, you know, with that felony on my record, I know they'll put me away for a long time. So I think for me, it's like openly embracing being an ex-con, being a felon, being a prisoner, being somebody who was at like the bottom of the barrel, and be that motivation to coming up out of out of the bottle, you know?
Now, in the present moment, from jail to modeling and being an actor. How did you make that transition?
So I'm like a, I'm a firm believer in just like karma and coincidences and things like that. So when I was inside prison in Rush City, that the hard prison, I had gotten into trouble, went to the hole, and then I went to this place called The Shoe. So I was inside a cell for 23 hours a day. I'd get out for an hour a day to work out or make phone calls, shower, just one of them pretty much I had time to do. But there was a guy who was a swamper in there, which is a janitor. And this guy's name is Tony Vincent Crecciello. He has a huge history of being like a mobster and a mafia hitman, which, I mean, I guess it's not unheard of inside prison. But for me, I looked up to somebody like that, like, dang, this guy has all this power, all this like money, this respect. Like, he's an influential person. Not now he's in prison, but like who this guy was. And he took a liking to me when I was inside prison. But you got to remember, I was inside a cell for 23 hours a day, and he was a swamper. So it was me and him conversating through a door. But this guy told me, dude, you have like this look to be a model. You like, I'm not like that type of guy, but like, you know, I'm in prison. You just do it. He's like, so over this 3 months that I sat inside this Shoe area before I'd get moved to a different area, this was like the trouble area for the wing. I had these conversations where like, he's telling me to go read this book, go read Nietzsche, go read Niccolo Machiavelli, go read all these like scholars, philosophers, and read, come back and tell me what you learned. So then I'd read this book and I was like, okay, if I didn't respect this guy, I would have never read a book and then went and talked to him, right? But I kept looking up to this guy like, man, like this is who I wanted to be. And he kept telling me like, what you're looking up to, kid, if I had a second of your time to go do something different, I would. Like, don't be that same mistake that I made. Go do something great. Promise me you're going to go do this. So he made me promise him that I would go to an agency. And I was like, dude, I'm going to go to construction and do what I've done all my whole life and do like roofing or something like that. But I promised him before I left, gave him a hug. He was tearing up and stuff like that. And it was like, he'd really become a good friend to me. Like, it was my mentor.
That's amazing.
This, 86-year-old Sicilian from Italy. Mobster. So like, that's why I tell people a lot of the time, right? Look, find out who, if somebody like a dad comes to me and like, my kid's messing up, what do I do? My daughter's smoking weed or my daughter's doing drugs. Like, what do? I always tell them, who did they look up to? Who is the person that they most admire or they're most trying to be like? And for me, I was just trying to be like this top mobster criminal that like has all these things that I think I don't need. Just a misconception wearing this mask, right? But when I met that and came face to face with this guy, he's telling me, this ain't what you want. This isn't the lifestyle. You'll be here in this prison with me sitting the rest of your life. So from there, it was me promising this guy to go. And then I got told no 100 times, right? People are telling me, no, you got way too many tattoos. And I have way less than I have now, right?
Oh, really?
Yeah, I have way less. None on my throat and like none on my hands. So it was kind of a struggle getting told no, but I was so resilient and I was so focused on like getting what I felt like I deserved or just like what my talent deserved. So eventually one agency in Minneapolis would give me this opportunity, and they have an office in LA and Minnesota. So they would connect me with just these resources and a network of people that like, when they would hear my story, they'd be like, man, you've come from the bottom. So like, yeah, let's work with you.
Yeah, we'll give you the opportunity.
Give me the opportunity, which I'm so thankful for the people who have. And from there, it's been like, I've done so many book covers. I've been in, you know, movies, work for different companies, huge corporations. It's like, it's a blessing that I took that guy's advice, my mentor.
Better late than never, right?
Sure.
Now, how did prison change you? Do you feel it changed you for better or for worse?
Yeah, yeah. So like what I can most relate it to is when I hear people talk about religion, right? They say, I had a change of heart and a change of mind. That's what prison did for me. It completely changed. And that could be with the faith that follows in and just finding myself, really finding out what I believe in, my morals, why I believe in something. I think that's all, that's what shaped a lot of that was prison was showing me like who the person I need to be and living up to my potential. Like I used to hear inside prison, this counselor say, we all know what we're supposed to be doing. We all know how we're supposed to be doing it. If not, we'll find the way, but we just refuse to live up to our potential. So like, that's been my goal since release is like hit the ground running, live up to my potential in everything I do. So,
yeah. Do you feel that without prison, you might not have reached this potential that you've reached now?
Oh, I'd for sure be dead.
Yeah.
100%. Yeah. Yeah. I tell people that all the time, that prison was like the biggest blessing of my life. Not the fact that I lost all that time, but like,
yeah, just the lessons.
It was lessons. The lessons. Yeah. Yeah. And then meeting, I would have never met Tony had I not gone to prison. And I don't know, maybe I wouldn't have found my way or learned my lesson. Like had I just heard it from some random guy who was like still on that path to being a criminal or something, you know,
exactly.
Like Tony had been through it. Tony had been in prison for 45 years, did all that time by the time I had met him. And yeah, he's like family now. Yeah. He's like, yeah.
They're like, well, if you did and you didn't like it, I'm
yeah,
done.
Yeah, yeah. This is definitely the path I'm looking to take. Yeah, yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. Yep.
Now for a final question, what advice do you have for those that may be going through similar situations or life experiences? For those maybe just getting out of prison or getting a second chance like you did?
Yeah, yeah. So I would say that anybody who, and this could literally be like a kid who's on the path to wanting to choose to do some criminal stuff tonight or today or something like that.
Don't do it.
Listen up. I tell people don't waste your time. A lot of that, right? Like we don't know how long we're going to be here.
Yeah.
I lost 6 years of my life to maybe a mistake that I could have done. You know, maybe I could have called the police. Maybe I could have handled it differently. So like take everything with a grain of salt and as a blessing. Don't let an opportunity pass you by that you can literally alleviate the burden on somebody. So like if I see somebody, if I'm walking by something, like please, if you can in me, I have to alleviate the burden to some capacity, whether it's money, saying hi, whatever it may be. I think just being a good person radiates that karma coming back for people.
Yeah.
That at least for me, that's what I found, that like being a good person, good just comes tenfold for you and it makes you feel good about yourself. And I love reaching back to the people that are in those similar footsteps and telling them like, own your story, take all that bad that you think about yourself. Like I said, I tell everybody I'm an ex-con, so take whatever it is about your story and just embrace it, own it, own up to it. Don't try to go around the issue as in, yeah, yeah, don't try to hide it, embrace it. And it's what we learn from the mistakes. If you're not learning anything and going back to it, you know, it was just kind of a waste of time. So yeah, yeah, don't give up. Stay motivated, own your story. Yeah, yeah, embrace your brand, make yourself everything you can, everything that you believe in. So.
And become a model.
Yeah. And become a model. You know, no, not for just, every president or prisoner, but yeah.
No, I love your story. I love the fact that you're able to just share it with everybody. I know we were talking that you're going to start going back to the prisons where you were and, you know, and try to talk to people. And that's so motivating.
Yep. Yep.
So
yeah,
thank
yeah.
you.
Yeah, yeah. I'm excited. I think that speaking to that population, I can encourage, motivate them to do a little bit better when they get out. And
of course, because you've been through it.
Yeah,
it's almost
yeah.
like the rehab groups, the AAs. I think it kind of works because they've been through it.
Yeah.
So they talk about personal experience.
Yeah, yeah.
It's going to be amazing.
A lot of people always try to tell me, like, get into ministry, but I feel like I'm doing, like, street ministry more than anything. Or going into prisons, you know? Like, I think I'm doing my work there. So
that's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for coming and
yeah.
thank you for sharing your story. I love this conversation.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you guys for watching or listening. We'll be here next week. If you liked what you see, leave us a comment and don't forget to subscribe. Bye.